Welcome to the Wellness Renaissance Podcast, exploring topics to help you find the pieces that fit into your health puzzle.
Knowing what I know as a physician, I didn't think it was COVID. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what it was. And I assumed, because of my age group, possibly a coronary or cardiac something. So we put in place, my husband and I sat down before I went into the emergency room, put in place my decision process, informed consent, what happened if I lost consciousness, would I do a ventilator, what type of surgeries I would do, wouldn't do. So whatever decisions needed to be made, we had those made before we went in. Who knows what's going to happen? But the first time I was in the hospital, I had some type of experience that then led me to wake up, jump out of bed, and say, my name is Mary, and I want to live. How to bring health security to people.
Yeah.
You know, when you look at the whole concept of trauma, which we've experienced with this pandemic, trauma, current trauma, then triggers old trauma. So things that happen to us as youngsters, as kiddos, young adults, gets triggered when we're facing some of these things now. And so if that trauma was never treated or healed, then trauma patterns just repeat. Mm-hmm. So that is something that we need to look at. That's in the area of mental health. Part of the pandemic fallout or collateral damage is going to be mental health.
Hey, you guys, this is Judy with Wellness Renaissance and the Wellness Renaissance Podcast. How are you doing in this crazy time we are in? I hope you're doing well and staying safe and staying sane. It's a tricky time. As you heard from the beginning, I have a very interesting conversation to share with you guys today. Dr. Mary Lauder is a family medicine physician, osteopathic physician, integrative medicine, and holistic certified. We're going to talk about that and her near-death experience with COVID-19. She didn't know that's what she had until quite a bit later. She shares some common sense things and really doable things that we can do to take care of ourselves and keep ourselves strong during this time of quarantine and going back out into the world. Why this is sometimes such a challenge to get good and solid information and some hope for what good might come out of all of this and a lot more too. So I think you're going to enjoy the conversation and information. I do want to say a little late happy Mother's Day to everybody of mothers of children and fur babies, etc. And also, of course, to all the graduates. I know this is a huge graduating weekend, and I certainly have interesting memories of my graduation of high school and college. College for me wasn't all that long ago. High school, couldn't get out fast enough. I actually ditched my last semester of high school and went to college. Best thing I ever did. I highly, highly, highly recommend it. It was good for many, many, many reasons. It saved my personal sanity, but man, if you can get that college experience going and get some of those college classes underneath your belt, that is also a win. And I know for many people, the high school experience is also very important. And you should definitely have that as well if that is something that is meaningful and exciting to you. For me, it was something to escape. So I am so happy there were options. I know this is a time of celebration and fun, and I keep hearing people saying they don't get to graduate this year. And I know you're missing the big walk and the big party, and that's a big thing, but don't underestimate the graduation piece. You've done the work. You've earned it, man. Take that and run with it. It's been a lot of time and effort into it. Find a way to celebrate now or in the future, but don't take the power away from actually graduating. That is still happening. Nonetheless, I get it. The rite of passage celebration is kind of being taken right out from under you, and these times are definitely cray cray. I hope you can make the best of it and make it special and unique in your way and something you will talk about for the rest of your life. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for being a part of the podcast, for sharing the podcast. If you think this message can help somebody else, please do not hesitate to pass it on. That is a majorly beautiful way an important way to support the podcast. So thank you, thank you, thank you. Of course, you can find more episodes on wellnessrenpodcast.com. It's also where you can sign up for our weekly emails. And if you feel so called to support the podcast in a financial way, please feel free and absolutely welcome and appreciate it to sign up as a Patreon supporter. And you can do that right on the webpage where it says become a patron. And take a moment to look below that become a patron button and notice all of the folks under the friends of the podcast. Those are other supporters. And I, of course, want to thank all of you who are supporting the podcast. We appreciate you so very much. Before we dive in, I want to thank our sponsors of the podcast, Green Home Solutions. You can find out what they do and what they're all about at greenhomesolutions.com. They are indoor air quality experts working with mold, disinfection, odor, and allergen control. Their products are plant-based, and people with chemical sensitivities can typically handle what they are using, which is a huge thing for many, many people. Also, pet-friendly. There is a lot you can find out on the website about the company, the products, their process, how they work, and all the things that they do. So definitely check them out. If you have an issue and you're not really sure they're a good fit, I still suggest myself giving them a call anyway to say, here's what's going on. And they can tell you if it's a right fit or not, or maybe come check it out and see if it's something that they can help you with, which is how I ended up working with them. It was great and helpful and wonderful, and I appreciate it so much. Here in Duluth at 218-206-9549. You can find them at greenhomesolutions.com. All right, let's join Mary.
I am super excited to have you here, Mary. You and I connected on a deaf cafe just recently, and I have learned so much about you since then. And I am thrilled to have had us come together in that space.
That was a good meeting. And I love that our host, you being one and Sarah being the other one, called it the Death Cafe.
That was really yes. Yeah. Well, that is actually a whole movement. I mean, it's a whole thing. It started in England. It is a whole thing. It's something that you actually have to sign up to do and say, I will follow these rules, which are mostly that, you know, they're pretty benign rules, but they're trying to keep it very kind of pure in its intent. Cool. It's been an amazing experience for us to do. And I love it. You have you have a lot of very interesting things going on, but one of the things I want to talk about today and start off having people get to know you and your experience is that you had a very near death experience with COVID-19 a little while back. And let's talk about that. And then I also, I want to have you introduce yourself. You are also a physician.
Yes.
And so I want to bring in your expertise because my gosh, this is something that people are just feeling like they're having a hard time getting information about. And then you also come from a holistic perspective too. So I'm, you know, wondering what pieces can you add to help us understand about what we're hearing and maybe what we're not hearing. What are the things you can do? What can we do maybe to advocate or to help our immune system? So there's a lot there that we can talk about, but I want to start by having you introduce yourself and then let's talk about your COVID experience.
Okay, that sounds great. Well, it's a pleasure to be here. You know, having mentioned we hooked up on the Death Cafe, and then you're right, our experiences crossed after that, and we just really had some great synergy with topics around not only just death and dying, but choice, understanding your diagnosis, informed consent, all those things that are just so important during this time. And those decisions are based upon how good is the information that you're receiving, right? So it's, you know, it's a garbage in, garbage out. Good stuff in, good stuff out. So the better information that you have for decision making, the better decision a person can make. So, and personally, you're correct. I had COVID, but didn't know I had COVID, like the majority of people in our country. I'm sure I got exposed by one of my patients because I had a few patients in February that were quite sick and I examined them. And I remember a couple of them that just gave a really good cough and I got a real dose of, you know, their respiratory droplets, which is not typical. I usually examine patients in a safe fashion, but they just, I think they were sicker than they thought as well. So I think it was just one of those things. You know, we occasionally get exposed. And I've been a physician, an osteopathic physician, family medicine board certified, and integrative medicine holistic certified for 27 years. And so, taint much I haven't seen, and taint much I'm afraid of. Although I was a little afraid of this one. And it was just a couple weeks after I got exposed that I started having some upper respiratory symptoms. I went up and spoke at a medical conference in Vail the first week in March, and I really struggled for air and had difficulty breathing. So I got home after the conference thinking, okay, I'm out of the high altitude, and now I'm just in altitude because we live just outside of Boulder, and I still couldn't breathe. So knowing what I know as a physician, I didn't think it was COVID. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what it was, and I assumed, because of my age group, possibly a coronary or cardiac something. So we put in place, my husband and I sat down before I went into the emergency room, put in place my decision process, informed consent, what happened if I lost consciousness, would I do a ventilator, what type of surgeries I would do, wouldn't do. So whatever decisions needed to be made, we had those made before we went in. Shared all my passwords, did all the things. I thought, who knows what's going to happen? Mm-hmm. And so when I got to the ER, we found that my oxygen was very low, 76%. Now, they're supposed to be in the 90s, mid to high 90s, and it was 76, so that's very low. So I was immediately put on oxygen and worked up for a number of things, which it was not my heart, wasn't coronary, so that was good. It wasn't a blood clot in my lung or a pulmonary embolism, that's good. But they did a CAT scan and found the ground glass appearance, and I had all this fluid in my lungs. And so then the fact that I had traveled to Vail, they then came in and said, and they were all at that time, then all dressed in personal protective equipment. And they said, we're going to put you in isolation.
Wow.
And I'm like, what? I said, I think I missed the memo on that one because, you know, we were looking at other reasons and they said, oh, you know, the doctor didn't tell you. And I said, no, the doctor didn't tell me. And so
got to feel so intimidating. Like I'm thinking about that in my own experience and I would be like, oh my gosh, I'm radioactive. What the heck happened to me?
And because my oxygen was still low a bit and I was recovering from how low it was, I'm not sure I was thinking clearly, but I also didn't protest because I wasn't thinking clearly. So it was a little bit of both. And I just didn't feel good. So at that point I'm like, okay, I'll just go with it. And it was the right thing to do, you know, knowing down the road, but they did a COVID test and the test was negative. But I didn't find out about the results of the test until 2 days after I was out of the hospital. Mm-hmm. And I was in the hospital for 2 nights and 3 days, which is kind of a long stay these days. Now, a lot of the COVID patients we know are in for 10, 12, 14 days. So they're, you know, they've got more days in the hospital. But at that point in the COVID journey for our nation, 3 days being hospitalized is a lot for an otherwise, you know, middle-aged, somewhat healthy, mostly healthy adult. Mm-hmm. So the perspective on that, when I was in medical training in the 90s, is we discharge people home now more sick than what we used to admit people to the intensive care unit then.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so, you know, I went home sicker than what I would have been sent to the ICU for, you know, just a, you know, mere 20 years ago. So when I left the hospital, I was still sick and then received word that I was COVID negative. And I found out later from my internal medicine doctor that that batch of tests that they did in the hospital were the ones that were, that came from the CDC that did not work. Mm-hmm. So we reviewed all of my CAT scans, my ultrasounds, my lab work. She goes, 100% this was COVID. My liver enzymes were 10 times normal. Obviously, the CAT scan findings, I had fever. I couldn't breathe, you know, and that it was just, I couldn't, my lungs wouldn't move. And so I just couldn't get air in, couldn't get air out, couldn't get air in. So, and that visit with my internal medicine doctor came about almost a month after I was out of the hospital.
Oh, wow.
And so, I had, you know, wisely self-isolated at home and recovered. It took me quite a while to recover. And so we did, you know, we had masks because I had some for my office, and, you know, we did all the right things just by decision-making. So, but what happened in the hospital was, and I can't say if this was a hallucination, if this was a dream, if I had, you know, people visiting from, you know, the other side of the veil. I don't know. I can't prove any of that. But the first time I was in the hospital, I had some type of experience that then led me to wake up, jump out of bed, and say, my name is Mary, and I want to live. And that was kind of an end of a long year because I lost both my parents last year. My father died a couple days before Thanksgiving in 2018, and then my mom passed away unexpectedly in March of 2019. So 2019 was characterized by a significant year of grief and loss. And I don't think I was struggling with grief, but I definitely experienced a deep amount of grief. And I ended up in the hospital with COVID almost a year to the day that my mom first went in the hospital when she had a traumatically dissecting aorta. And so none of that was lost on me, I'll tell you that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my mom had a surgery and was not able to recover from the surgery. And in fact, it was a surgery she never should have had. But the fact that she passed away just a year prior to me being in the hospital, that was not lost on me. And it was probably part of the experience I had that first night of deciding that I wanted to live. Mm-hmm. So I think that came from a deep emotional and spiritual aspect of my being and my sense of self. But what I recall is with not being able to breathe and just feeling sicker and sicker. I mean, I couldn't take two steps without stopping to try and catch some air. And that's a very, very unique feeling. And it's beyond alarming. It's into the scary. And so I was definitely scared when I went to the hospital because I didn't know what was wrong and I didn't know what was going to happen. And the interesting thing, I had signed up for the end of April to attend a retreat regarding death and dying and dealing with one's own death so you can actually live more fully. Mm-hmm. And so obviously this topic was on the forefront. So, as it goes, the retreat was canceled, but I think I still attended the retreat kind of on the personal level.
Right. Well, yeah. No kidding.
Yeah. So, you know, having that experience made me look at our national response, our recommendations, our understanding of COVID much differently. I think had I not had the experience of being sick, I would have been pretty intellectual about it. I would have had empathy because I understand how it feels to not feel good. But I looked at the data. I looked at the communication. I looked at what the recommendations were, where they were coming from, what the fear mongering was doing, how people were reacting. And I would say I have a unique perspective on the pandemic, because also as a physician, I own a private office. Mm-hmm. And I can now say I used to own a private office because over 95% of my work was elective and with patients who were immunocompromised, translation, they couldn't come to the office. And being out of the office for over 6 weeks just wiped out my business, because here in Colorado, they closed down the elective medical procedures from the mid part of March, which was just about a week after I got out of the hospital.
Oh,
so
right.
Just when I might have been going back to work, they closed everything down.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, while I was looking to recover, you know, I got hit again with, you know, closing and my business just literally evaporating. So again, I think, you know, feeling loss on an additional level and experiencing the pandemic on an additional level, you know, I think has given me some perspective on things.
Yeah, that's a lot to handle, you know, with everything, and then just the COVID and the business.
It is.
I want to ask you about the perspective that you have. Let's go there. First, talk about the unique perspective, because I think, you know, again, that's something we're all seeing. We're all seeing so many different views and perspectives, and it's mind-boggling trying to figure out what should I be taking away from this? Who do I believe? And I know that you're not necessarily saying you have those answers, but your perspective is deep and it's real.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I spend some days not even know who to believe, to be honest. And I'm a good listener and I'm a good watcher of body language and I'm a good understander of people.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I just made up a word there, understander. but I'm a good understander. I think what we're, you know, I try to understand what their motives are, not subscribing motives to them, but for example, news media, they're meant to sell stories.
Mm-hmm.
TV's meant to sell advertising, not necessarily meant to inform, but you know, the majority part is if we follow the money trail, we can find a lot of things in this country, right?
Right.
So I think, you know, we see a clash of things that look like capitalism, things that look like people taking advantage in the pandemic, things that look like people having answers. And then you have to be suspect because this is a novel virus. Novel means it's new. Novel means is we haven't really been this way before. So, and wherever there is non-consensus on a treatment, meaning, you know, well, I'm not sure if this works. I'm not sure if that works. Well, we'll try this. We aren't sure. That means we really don't know. And so I think, and nobody is comfortable. That's an absolute. A lot of people are not comfortable in medicine saying we don't know. And I think it's okay to say that because it's the truth. Now, I might know more than the average bear because I'm a physician in terms of medical stuff, but that still doesn't mean I know everything. And so then, you know, a statement or messaging like, well, because this is new, we're trying to figure this out. This is what we know can be helpful. Social distancing. Why? Well, because you're staying away from one another. Hand washing, why? Because then your hands are clean. Wiping counters, why? Because we know other viruses tend to land and stay on counters and containers. And that's, we know other viruses are passed this way. We assume this one does that too until further notice, wipe mm-hmm. everything down. You know, so you can have a measure of an educated message without having to have the answers. The treatment, I didn't get any anti-malarial drugs or Plaquenil, which is the hydroxy drug that was so pushed. I didn't get that. I actually got a really strong antibiotic that I probably didn't need and has some very serious side effects to it. And I've had some of those side effects. So, but it was also the best decision at the time. I don't fault any of the doctors for that because you know, we were dealing with information in clinical medicine. It's not black and white. It's not hard and fast. It's, you know, what do we know? What's the history, the physical exam, and what laboratory values support your history and physical exam. That's how you make your diagnosis. So the fact that, you know, my internist put all that together after I got out of the hospital, that was the best work ever. And she had treated COVID patients. So she said, based upon your history, your exam, what your test showed, you definitely had it, even though that one particular lab test said I didn't. Mm-hmm. So that's how clinical medicine is. It's very gray. And it made sense that I had had COVID based upon how I felt, where my oxygen went, and, you know, other patients' type or other patients' experience of all of a sudden you just can't breathe and that happens really fast. Mm-hmm. So I think we can have a measure of safety and what we know is typical public health. You know, this is common sense to wash your hands, common sense to stay away, stay home. It's common sense to wear a mask. I mean, we do that if a patient came into my office and was suspect of strep throat, I put a mask on. I don't really want to get strep throat. If I work in an urgent care and we have, you know, influenza season or we know pneumonia is going around, most of the people that were really sick that had high fevers and things like that, when I would go in to examine them, I would wear a mask. Why? Just to protect myself. So some of this isn't that far off from just good hygiene and things that we know to be true. You know, I honestly can't speak to the shutting down of our economy. Mm-hmm. I'm not an economist. I don't have a master's in public health. So I can't speak to that. What I do see and what I do wonder is, was COVID here in America a little sooner than we thought? Mm-hmm. Based upon my experience, and you can't take it away from me because it is my experience, my opinion from my experience is I think it probably was. Mm-hmm. So the key to this whole understanding from a public health standpoint, a personal health and diagnosis, from what we call population health, what happens in a population, how do we track their diagnosis, treatment, outcomes, you know, things like that. That's all tracked with data. And this is where I think as a country, we've done a horrible job. We don't have the data. We don't have tests. People still can't get tests. And people were denied tests. And the tests we had were not good tests. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm chuckling because I have worked in data gathering and population health. And this is just, you know, it was unbelievable to watch this not unfold in the way that would be helpful. So it's hard to make decisions about opening up economies, returning to work, where are we in the pandemic? Because we don't have the data to make those decisions.
Right. That makes sense to me. And everything that I've heard, I was just on a public health webinar yesterday and listening to one of the other states talk about trying to figure out how to open. And basically that was their thing. They were like, we want to do things and we need to get the economy going, but we also need to keep people, you know, safe, and so that people know that they're safe coming here if they need to come here, you know, those kinds of things. And I think that's a big scary thing. And I know certainly some people have said, well, what's testing really going to do? What information is it really going to give? But I do think the tracking of the numbers seems like a pretty, you know, because we don't have enough. If we had more data, we could maybe say, yeah, you're right. This is how it's affecting. And so we know that we can do these things securely. And one of the questions that comes up too is that whole piece of, and of course the hard part with the economy is that there are people falling through the cracks and there are people who are losing their business. And that is devastating to me.
Yes.
The question that comes up too is just the fact that if we're all locking ourselves in our houses, and we're not getting exposed to other people's germs, are we actually hurting our immune system by not getting just the sort of everyday education that our immune system needs to build up, which I can make sense of, but then I also think, but then if there's this, you know, then if I go out and get COVID, you know, granted, I'm not a high risk person, So I don't know. I'm trying to balance my brain around all of that. What are your thoughts around that, if you have any?
Yeah. You know, I don't know that we know. That's the thing. We, you know, the stay at home idea is meant, it's, you know, taken from the days of the plague. You stay home because the plague's blown over. When it blows over, you come back out again. So I think that's a short-term answer, a short-term solve. The long-term solve is going to be, you know, how many people send their kiddos to school while they have a fever? Mm-hmm. How many people send their kiddos to school at any age who have a runny nose and don't feel well? Could our schools be prepared to, you know, do some online work or send work home differently for kids who are ill? You know, do people want to change how their routine looks because we might look at sickness differently? And most of us tend to push through the viruses we do have.
Right.
Because, oh, it's just a cold. But we don't really think about being in public and exposing others. So a lot of the decisions and a lot of the questions I get is, how do I not get sick? Well, how about we reframe that? How do you not share what you have with others?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the reason I say that, it brings up the whole idea of putting a mask on. The CDC is recommending it. Our governor here in Colorado said everybody who goes outside out of their yard should have a mask. I go bike riding and walking. Less than 10% of people have masks on. And they're, you know, and they're saying, well, I won't get something. How do you know you won't transmit something?
Right.
So that's, to me, that's the thing. It's a mindset of, well, what's going to happen to me versus how can I take care of others? And philosophically, spiritually, you know, that's really at the heart of this. One of the things at the heart of this pandemic is how we take care of and look out for one another. And, you know, people may not agree with me, and that's fine. But one of the things that we have to do is we have to really look at how we live in our communities.
Right. Thinking about that kind of paradigm shift, because you're right. There's so many people in the beginning of this, the statement was, you know, yeah, I'm young. I'll be fine. You know, and I'm probably going to be okay if I get it. Like, it'll probably eventually, but I don't like the hospital systems, and I want more treatments to be available. If, you know, more options, I want to know how to navigate, and I don't want to pass it to somebody else. I don't necessarily have a lot of other people to, you know, to support if I'm sick. It's a very lonely little venture, and that doesn't mean that I won't ever get it. I'm not kidding myself to think that, well, I will isolate myself and never ever get it. It's just like, but I want more information. I want us to know more. And I certainly don't want to be the person to pass it to a bunch of other people. You know, I mean, I think about in normal life, the way it used to be, how many times don't we go to work because, well, we don't have sick pay, or we don't have time to take off, or we've got this thing we need to do today, and we mostly feel okay. And, you know, so, and how many people have you worked for where they don't believe you if you stay home, so you show up sick so they can send you home?
Right. And as a doctor, you know, there's a number of things that I went to work with having that fall under, and I tried to get coverage, you know, to say to cover a shift or to cover what I was doing, and there wasn't anybody available. And I literally had to show up when I really needed to be home or in a clinic getting treatment myself. Mm-hmm. And so it's definitely frowned upon for physicians to be ill. So, you know, I think this is something we have to look at, and we need to be willing to adjust our perspective so we can have a different outcome. If we don't adjust how we think on this, we're just going to get the same outcomes we currently have, because we're just be, you know, repeating what we currently do. And to assume that we can get any other type of outcome by doing the same thing over and over again is not correct. Mm-hmm. So,
and that doesn't mean that in my mind, that doesn't mean that we could, I mean, I have no idea what's going on behind the scenes really, right? Like you just hope right. that people are working. You want to believe they're working for your best interest. Not only, yes, the economy is a piece of it, but the personal health and wellness is also a piece of it. And, you know, and it's just been very fascinating. Like you say, the kind of the mindsets that we have of the whole, well, you know, it's, how many times didn't I hear, well, it's just going to take old people and immunocompromised people. And I'm like, have you looked at the statistics of America? That's a lot of people.
Right. It is. And I, you know, in every life, everybody who has perished as a result of this virus has a life story. They have a life they lived, a family they raised, a family that they were once a child in. Neighbors, kids they grew up with, fun times, best friends, you know, and when I take care of patients, I think of those things. I just don't think, oh, another diagnosis of the same thing. Mm-hmm. And so it's overwhelming when these folks came in and literally just succumbed to the virus so quickly. I mean, that is just nothing but trauma on all sides, trauma for the patient who died in such a way, trauma for the patient's family and friends, and trauma for the physicians, nurses, and other healthcare workers that took care of them. Complete right. trauma. So I think, you know, and then we layer on the unknown of whether we label that or anchor that to the data, or not having clear treatments yet, or not having a vaccine, all those things, you know, and that creates a heightened sense of awareness, also known as anxiety and fear, that can keep our immune system on edge, but not always in a good way. Mm-hmm. And then we've got, you're right, the insecurity or the lack of food, housing, shelter. Many people that lost their jobs also lost their insurances. Mm-hmm. So this whole pandemic speaks, and I think really kind of pulled the curtain back on changes that perhaps our country could make so we have more security in those areas.
Yeah, I think if we walk away from this and we really truly make some shifts and think about how do we do this better, mm-hmm. Then at least we have gained some beautiful wins out of it. Because I, you know, there's a meme on Facebook that I basically, you know, said we don't have a booming economy if people are two paychecks away from right. not living. And I absolutely, that has been my personal meme for a really long time. You know, yeah. we say that we're doing so well, but there's so many, it's an elite group of people. And it's easy, I think, for, you know, for many of us to be sort of weirdly comfortable, because we're kind of okay. We're not maybe always thriving, but we're okay. And we can look at other places and go, well, they have it worse than we do. So gosh, I'm okay. And I'm thinking, my gosh, we live in this country where we have this amazing education and this amazing amount of resources, and we can't pull this together. How do we expect people of, you know, lower socioeconomic statuses who are trying to build themselves up, you know, like you say, we're pulling back the curtain. It's showing itself when we've got people who, you know, the statement is, well, some of the people who are working are making less money working a 40-hour week and sometimes more than they would if they were on unemployment right now. That's a messed up statement.
Yeah.
Like, the fact that that is a reality and these people are essential workers, that is crazy. And I have no idea how to solve it or what to do about it. But boy, I think we need to be able to have a conversation, and there needs to be really good people figuring out what do we do? What do we do with this information, and how do we build a country that is strong and vibrant and thriving? Because, man, we got a lot of potential here.
Yeah, I do think that, you know, we've got an opportunity to observe, adjust, and change. And I do hope that we can make some adjustments for sure. You know, thinking then, what can I do as an individual? Mm-hmm. You know, what does that look like? Well, first and foremost, take care of yourself. And that looks like the following. Make sure you don't indulge in too much alcohol, sugar, foods that don't have nutritional value, commonly known as junk foods, that are full of chemicals, preservatives, colorings. Well, why? Why would you even say that, Dr. Lauder? Well, because we know those things can trigger the immune system in an excitatory fashion. Very solid data with that. Well, if your immune system's kind of getting sidetracked because it's having a circus or a carnival over in the corner, you get hit with something, a virus, and in this case, we're talking COVID, you don't have as much reserve to fight things off. So that's one thing. Sleep patterns are very important. Getting out and getting regular exercise and sunshine, we know that those things do help. And people say, well, what can I take to prevent COVID? Well, I don't think there's anything you can do to prevent COVID because it has to do with getting exposed to the virus and whether or not that viral load, meaning the amount of the virus, takes hold in your system and, makes its way into infection. Now, one needs to understand that a virus is a living organism, but it's not a bacteria that has a cell wall and a nucleus and things like that. It's basically a pirate. A virus is a pirate. It goes into our body, invades a cell, and takes over the cell. When it takes over the cell, it begins to replicate. So it hijacks our system. So, just like in any type of hijacking, what are the safety measures against that? You want to have a good immune system. So when something comes and invades, you've got a first line of defense. Mm-hmm. Our first line of defense are our mucous membranes, which are basically anywhere mucus comes out of. Lots of orifices or holes in our body where mucus comes out of, right? So keep those moist. Put a little Vaseline in your nose or a little bit of a gel that keeps the mucous membranes moist. Make sure that you don't have bloody noses. Make sure that if you have allergies, you treat your allergies so your mucosa is not irritated and more susceptible to infections. Pretty basic stuff. Hand wash. Don't touch your nose. Don't touch your eyes. Don't touch your nose, then touch your eyes. And certainly don't wipe your hands across countertops and then touch all the above. So pay attention to what you're doing. Good nutrition is important. And then to supplement nutrition, you can use supplements. So that would be the good antioxidants, vitamin C. And that's good to take like 1,000 to 2,000 milligrams a day. Vitamin D. It's interesting, whole nother topic, vitamin D is actually more of a hormone than it is a vitamin. It just got in line the day they were labeling vitamins. So it's called the vitamin, but it's a hormone. So, and all healing in our body is driven by the endocrine or the hormonal system. So making sure we have adequate amounts of vitamin D, that looks like 5,000 to 10,000 international units a day. And that can be in a liquid or capsule form. Magnesium, about 200 to 400 milligrams. A good B vitamin, just a complex B vitamin. And zinc, 50 milligrams a day. Those are the basics that really keep cells happy and keep cells healthy. The more healthy the cells are, then you have healthy tissues. Healthy tissues give you healthy organs. Healthy organs give you a healthy organism. So that's, kind of some very solid building blocks for how to stay well. Mm-hmm. And so I think those things are important. There's, but hear this clear, there's nothing you can do to quote unquote prevent, or say I'm, preventing the virus. Well, preventing the virus means you don't get exposed to it. That's the best way. And that's why, the social distancing and all the other things we've put in place is a vital part of staying healthy and well. And then not being afraid. I mean, fear is something that stimulates our immune system into our fight or flight response. Or the other part, fight, flight, or freeze. And so when that occurs, we become more susceptible to infections.
I think that's what I think about when I think about the people who are falling through the cracks, right? The people who can't get the loans or can't get, because of one reason or another, they don't fit the business model, yada, yada. And I think about the fear and the concern, and then So they don't have the basic funds maybe that everybody else has to just take care of the basics. So then they're stressed and they're fearful and they're talking, you know, sometimes losing their business or potentially losing their home. And there you've got folks who have, you know, don't have the resources in place just because of circumstantial whatever, that have then the weakened immune system and they have the stress. And it's like, we're not taking care of those who need it in that case, and we're heightening the problem. And I think that's, for me, sometimes when I think about the stress on all of this and how this has been such a struggle, is I think of the people who are the ones that are most stressed because they have reality in their face about, you know, rent, whatever, that they're the ones who are, it's hard to just say, well, just don't stress about that.
Yeah. Well, some of that, I wonder if that's built upon our ability of resilience. Mm-hmm. You know, because we each, you know, there is a sense in there too of personal responsibility. Mm-hmm. And certainly trauma by its definition is anything that overwhelms our system, whether that's our immune system, nervous system, emotional system, hormone system, overwhelms our physical, emotional, spiritual sense of being. Mm-hmm. And so part of this pandemic is a trauma when people get sick. Part of it is some people carry the virus, pass it on, and they don't really get sick. I mean, my husband was with me in isolation, even though he had PPE on. He just got a sore throat and a little bit of a sinus.
Oh, wow.
And a cough. Mm-hmm. And he was very exposed to me when I was at my sickest, and he didn't have any mask or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So that, I think that's the other part of it, is the way the infections go, they almost feel arbitrary. And I think that's where some of the fear can come in as well, because no matter what you do well, it's possible you could still get the virus. Now, I don't think that it's exactly that linear, but some of the cases do feel arbitrary. And, mm-hmm. you know, I think we have to be very careful. You know, when people have, I think it's difficult to blame everything on the virus. Meaning, mm-hmm. Anything chronic has multiple factors to it. So if there's an acute thing that occurs and then it goes on for a while, then it transitions over to something chronic eventually, right? Acute pain turns into chronic pain after, say, 6 weeks or after 90 days. So we have kind of these parameters that we've given for definitions. So, you know, what's happening in our economy, is this an acute ding to our economy? Yes. Are there chronic underlying things that make us more susceptible? Yes. So I think we have to be really careful that to not blame the pandemic for everything, but it's just like it pulled back the curtain. Mm-hmm. And now we see kind of like the Wizard of Oz, what's happening behind the scenes. And is the wizard's pants on fire because he's not telling the truth? Or is his even pants off because, you know, he's got caught with his pants down? Or is it the emperor who has no clothes? I mean, I don't even know. And it's, you know, so I think this, you know, conflates into such deeper issues and chronic issues within our country that I'm not sure we can just say virus gone. Now, you know, this is going to be better.
Right.
This switch in a social program and people will do well.
Yeah. No, I absolutely agree. And I, like I said, I think that can be not saying it's easy, not saying any of that. I'm saying it could be a beautiful result of really being able to go, okay, there's all of these pieces at play. How do we work at making those pieces work better?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think we can, as a country, you know, look at how to bring health security to people.
Yeah.
You know, when you look at the whole concept of trauma, which we've experienced with this pandemic, trauma, current trauma, then triggers old trauma. Mm-hmm. So things that happen to us as youngsters, as kiddos, young in our families, young adults, gets triggered when we're facing some of these things now. And so if that trauma was never treated or healed, then trauma patterns just repeat. Mm-hmm. So that is something that we need to look at. That's in the area of mental health. And looking at delays in opening, looking at staying home, not being able to go back to work, those are huge trauma triggers. And part of the pandemic fallout or collateral damage is going to be mental health.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's something that's very serious, and our mental health needs to be addressed, and the mental health of the first responders, the frontline folks, whether, you know, I couldn't imagine working in a grocery store right now, you know, where some people come in, they don't social distance, they don't have a mask, whatever. And you're there, you know, putting food out for them. I'm not sure I would enjoy going to work.
Yeah.
And I know as a physician, after I got sick, I said, I'm staying home till I know I'm absolutely better. And I did everything by telemedicine because I didn't want to have a relapse, or I didn't want to expose anybody, you know, so I was very, very cautious. And I even had moments of fear, you know, a couple days when I had to get up and go do something. I'm like, oh my gosh, I don't even know if I want to leave the house. I don't know. It just seems like a scary world. And I had to really, really sort that through. And I am a resilient person. I do have good skills. I do understand empathy. I do understand taking good mental health care and things like that. And even that, in those situations, I got overwhelmed at times. So, you know, I think everybody has their story that they come to their day with. Everybody has their story that they've come through with. And so I think kindness, compassion, you know, somebody asked me earlier if I was wearing a mask out when I ride my bike to be a good example. Mm-hmm. I said, nope, I just want to keep a distance and take care of myself and take care of others who are out and about. I said, I'm not doing this for someone's opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing this because it's the right thing to do. You know, and caring for myself and caring for others.
Right.
Yeah.
So I have a question. I want to toss some of the treatment or ideas or some of the things that I'm hearing about the health perspective of treatments and protecting ourselves. And can I throw them at you and you can tell me if it's just a case of we don't know enough or whatever the case might be?
Yes.
I mean, these conversations are so interesting because I'm trying to figure this out for myself, as many other people are as well.
Yeah.
And we're hearing so much. So one of the things you had mentioned, zinc, and yeah. I have seen a few things talking about, I know one doctor in particular was talking about, you know, upping your zinc and then also drinking tonic water with quinine. And I don't know a whole lot about quinine, but my understanding from what he said is that it like allows the zinc and probably other things too, to actually get into your cells better. What do you know about that?
Well, my quinine I usually put in my gin and tonics. Mm-hmm. So the tonic water used to have quinine in it. So, and that's an antiviral for, you know, malaria. So, you know, I think about that. I have not heard of the combination of quinine and zinc making it increased availability to the cells. And that's what they're saying, meaning getting in the cells
mm-hmm.
and working better. Zinc by itself, anytime there's a mineral or an element, it's always going to work with other things in the cell. And those, when they're put together, they're called cofactors.
Mm-hmm.
And so you want a balance of cofactors to work so the cell can work at its best. If you put too much zinc in, magnesium, vitamin C, and other things will get blocked. Mm-hmm. So there's this dynamic of getting the right amount of everything in there. And so that's why too much quinine can have its side effects. So too much oxygen can have a side effect of knocking out your drive to breathe.
Mm.
Okay, so, you know, we have to, you know, the body, we have to give the body much more respect. It is completely resilient and has this wonderful inherent capacity to heal itself. we just got to get the ingredients kind of in the ballpark so that it can do what it does best, which is heal and live and, you know, and respond to the stresses we place upon it, right? Mm-hmm. So that was a long answer. So the vitamins, the minerals have to be balanced. That's why I said zinc at 50 milligrams, magnesium at 200 to 400 milligrams, vitamin C, 1 to 2,000 milligrams, a B complex. That's why I put that out. And you can, a person could even use some glutathione, which is 400 milligrams. Those are the basic cell and vitamin D at 5,000 international units. Those are the basic things that the cell needs for its optimum functioning. Hmm. So, and then again, you want that optimal cell functioning, which helps, you know, the cells come together. They make a tissue makes an organ makes an organism, mm-hmm. right? So that's why those doses are good. And that's why those particular items are good.
Now, and very reasonable. I mean, in the amounts you're saying and that kind of thing, in supporting the body to, like you say, do the best it can.
Right. Right. You know, and there's some evidence they've done some treatments in parts of the world with some things called high dose vitamin C, which is anywhere from 15 grams, which would be 15,000 milligrams, up to 25,000 milligrams, which is 25 grams. I think we have a little bit of data on that, but we can't say that that's absolutely a straight way through that's, you know, standing out. Ozone, which is O3, oxygen plus another O2 plus another oxygen to make it O3, it's put together in an electromagnetic fashion, does boost the immune system. When you have more oxygen, viruses are less likely to survive. You know, we've heard anecdotally, get outside, the virus exposed to air, exposed to the atmosphere tends to die. Mm-hmm. So what we know with our body, with almost any type of virus, is we increase our oxygen levels in our body, we get an immune response, and that can be antiviral. Studies for that come out of Italy and Russia and Cuba. And very interesting studies on that. Not directly at COVID or coronavirus, but just at viruses in general. So that's across a broad different type of different families of viruses. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I think we could extrapolate some things. And that's what we do in clinical medicine. There is not a black and white in clinical medicine. There just isn't.
I so appreciate you saying that, because that's not something we get to hear very often.
Right.
And it's just reality. I mean, any, you know, if you have a chance to talk to doctors when they're not being doctors in the office, or when they're just really being honest about stuff, you know, I had a doctor say to me, she's like, you know, we are all just doing the best we can with the information we have. That's all we have to work with. Yeah. And I love that. It's like, thank you. Like, it allows me to process better for some reason when I know that it's not, to me, it doesn't necessarily provide fear. It just lets me know it's reality and I can work with reality a little bit better. And it gives me permission to ask more questions, you know? Yeah. We don't have time for double blind placebos at this point. We're not far enough into this to have a lot of information. So it makes sense that we have to use the information that we have and think about, what does that actually mean?
Right. And if you use ozone, there are no side effects to it, you know, when administered correctly. Well, how do you know to administer it correctly? Well, how do you put oxygen on and administer it correctly? You use oxygen tubing and don't turn it up too high. So there's some basics there that, you know, but I think we can be, use some common sense with that. And people who are trained, and I'm fully trained and certified in ozone therapy, and, you know, the other thing is the UV light. Now, you know, we did have some discussions, you know, from our, you know, the leader of our administration in the nation saying, oh, just put things out to light, find a very powerful light. That's not what this is. Mm-hmm. UV light has different waves, it has an A wave, a B wave, a C wave. And we use that therapeutically by exposing blood to it. And when that occurs, it can be antiviral. I'm not saying I'm directly treating COVID, can't say that because, you know, I can't promise that. Mm-hmm. But that process and the use of UV light by using what's called a major autohemotherapy procedure can be antiviral. So that is a way that we would have options, you know, to treat. Now, and that research comes out to us out of those same countries, Russia, Cuba, Italy. The United States has some data on that. The challenge with these treatments that are from oxygen like ozone or light is that people cannot make billions of dollars on it like you can with the pharmaceutical drug. Mm-hmm. So there's no money for studies because no one can make $1 billion out of it.
Right.
So again, you know, kind of what I said at the beginning, follow the money trail. Mm-hmm. So what happens instead is these treatments, which have potential and can have potential, they get marginalized because there isn't the money in it. And you can't make billions of dollars and have privately traded companies and people get super rich off of these treatments.
Right. And I think that's why, you know, for me, in my personal experience with all of this, I, you know, I look at the treatments that they're doing, and I know I've heard really interesting feedback, and basically say that they don't think that we're treating it correctly, because they're saying their understanding is that they're treating it like it's pneumonia, but that's not what's actually happening in the lungs. And
so it's
interesting, because that leads to the question of, okay, what should we do? And I come from a perspective of, you know, I want the opportunity. I want to know more information that, like you said, isn't out there because there isn't money to have it out there. And I find that that's devastating to me. From, again, I want to live in a country where that's not, that my information isn't based on how much money somebody can make. I know that's the reality, but that is one of the broken pieces. And it's why I keep doing the searching and the discussions that I have, because I want to learn what's out there and what's available. That really is good stuff. Just it's not, no, there's no money for advertising. So I appreciate your, you know, your input, because I think that those are the things that are so incredibly important that we maybe don't know. And I'm not expecting everybody to know, but you know, if somebody can make the best decision working with me as a doctor, this is what we think. Here's your choices. We don't know if this works or not. We don't even know if the treatment that we've got is working, right? I mean,
right. Well, the one of the big things with the COVID-19 is that it causes a cytokine storm. The easy explanation of that is like inflammation that totally loses control. Mm-hmm. And that's what happens in the lungs, but that also happens in the liver. And that also happens in the blood vessels. And that also happens in the blood. So that's why we see this thing triggering so many different types of responses in people. Why the different responses? I believe from a clinical standpoint, it's because we have different genomes. We have different genetics. And our genome tells us a predisposition of, if we're in this type of environment and all these things come together in the perfect storm, what would happen? Some people tend to have problems where they would more blood clot. Some people tend to have problems with their lungs. That was the category I was in. Mm-hmm. Some would have tendency to have problems with their blood vessels. Some with their liver. I was also in that category. And that has to do with my genomic picture. It's a multi-system virus, meaning it hits more than one system in the body. Therefore, there's going to be multiple things that need to be used to treat it.
That makes sense. This is not a one size fits all.
Right. So I think one of the reasons why, and this is a novel virus, that we don't know exactly what it's doing. So we're learning, and we're literally building the plane while we're flying it, you mm-hmm. know? So I think that's why we have so many questions about the treatment and why so many things were given, you know, like the hydroxychloroquine. Well, that's, you know, is a medicine we use for autoimmune disease that has not been shown to be a treatment that works. Mm-hmm. But it was, you know, let's think of our paradigm. It was a tablet. We could manufacture it. It could be readily available and people could make money. Mm-hmm. So without being a conspiracy theory doctor, I'm just saying that is our current paradigm of thought. And again, you know, everything that we've talked about this morning has come down to if we really want to see a change in our country, we need to change our paradigms of thought. So mm-hmm. there's another example of that. And the pandemic, again, is just pulling back the curtain on our paradigms of thought.
Right. I know that you have to get going soon, but I wanted to ask you, you know, from a perspective of somebody who, you know, part of my fear personally around this is going into the hospital, sort of being pushed into doing what they want me to do. You know, and from the stories that I have heard, both read and personally, you know, some of these things happen very, very quickly. Yeah. And I know one person that I was talking to, you know, this person went into the hospital after a couple days of being sick. And they basically said, you've got 15 minutes, call who you want to. We're putting you on a ventilator. We don't know if you're going to wake up. Yeah. And she didn't wake up, sadly. But it's those moments that I think about pre-planning for.
Yeah.
Because that's, you're in panic mode at that point. And so in my mind, I want that little list in my pocket to go, okay, what do I do now so that I'm not wasting my time panicking? You know, in those types of situations, I feel like my concern for myself is how do I self-advocate to ask more questions, to really be heard? You know, I am one of those people who if I were to take another treatment, say I were to say, but I really want to do the vitamin C or I really want to do some of these other things, and I didn't live through that, for me personally, that's, I would rather go that way than on a ventilator. I would rather do some of these other options. How do I advocate for myself in those types of things where I need to ask more questions, but you're kind of being rushed along because these people have other people to deal with and they've got their agenda, right? Even though they might really care for you, they have their agenda too.
Yeah. Their agenda is to treat everybody who comes through the door and keep them alive. So again, we're going to go right back to our paradigms of thought need to adjust. Because the paradigm for the doctor that we come from is death is failure, mm-hmm. especially when we look at things and we say premature death. Well, how do we know what premature death is? Well, sometimes we do, right? But I mean, if we look at, step back and look at that philosophically, maybe that was really that person's time to die no matter what, mm-hmm. you know? And so that's a more of an esoteric question, but to practically answer what you're saying and asking is you write it down. And you write it down and you don't wait till a pandemic to do it. You write it down and you write down exactly what you want to have done. I will go on a ventilator. I won't go on a ventilator. I will go on a ventilator if I'm able to come off in 48 to 72 hours. Mm-hmm. I will take this antibiotic if I absolutely need to and there's no other treatment. I'm choosing to be here to have a diagnosis, have treatment options explained to me, and then I will make a decision. And the paradigm changes for both of that, for all of those situations, need to be adjusted both on the patient side and on the physician side. Because what you're correct, what goes through a physician's mind is when a patient comes in, the patient is providing their consent for treatment and care. Mm-hmm. And they get so far in, they go, well, wait a minute, says the patient, I don't want this, I don't want that. It's very easy for the physician to think and then to say, well, then why are you even here for my help?
Right.
And I get that. I've said those words. I've felt those feelings because you're like, well, okay, then get out of my ER because I could help someone else. Mm-hmm. Now, understanding that now, I wouldn't provide that answer now. I'm a little older, a little wiser, a little less, I don't know, more gentle perhaps. And I have faced situations where patients have come in and they are, do not resuscitate. And the very thing I need to do is resuscitate them. Mm-hmm. And I've stopped and said, okay, here's the patient's do not resuscitate orders. This is very clear. Oh, well, we aren't sure that that's what they meant. Well, this is what we have. And so upholding a do not resuscitate is just as important as if documentation does not exist, that you go and you try and do everything you can save a can do to save a patient. Mm-hmm. But the biggest thing is for the patient to know and to put some thought and time into it before they're in a panic situation. And I did that when I went to the hospital. Mm-hmm. My husband and I talked through everything that, and you know, if they wanted to do this, I would not agree to this. You know, certain surgeries I wouldn't agree to and things like that. And I said, if that shortens my life, that's how it is, but I'm not going to do those things. And I know the system. Mm-hmm. And so, but I also know that it is a system. And, you know, and that was one of the things that we went through in relationship to my mom when she had her traumatic aortic dissection. Mm-hmm. And so we had to deal with things that really had no authorization provided for that the hospital and physicians did.
You had said that she had a surgery that she should not have had.
Right. On so many levels. And she never gave informed consent for it. So, you know, and that's going to open me personally and professionally up to a whole new level of work going forward of things I want to do. But I think in this situation, I think the burden where health education, public health education, personal health education can occur is, what does a ventilator mean? What does it look like? What does it do? Yeah. And so those discussions need to be had.
Yes.
And in the pandemic and in the panic mode, you're right. That's not your best decision making. Physicians are trained in that mode to do what they can to save a life. Mm-hmm. And especially if there's no other direction, they're always going to move to save a life. And that's why the whole concept of what's called patient autonomy, what do you understand and what you really want done, needs to occur. And that again gets back to, we need a paradigm change.
Yeah.
So maybe this should just be called paradigm change pandemic.
I would love to see it. I would love to be able to say to a doctor, hey man, this isn't on you. If I choose this other thing, you do the best for me. You tell me what you know. And if I make this choice and it's the wrong choice, but I've made it out of the best education that I have or the people that I trust have given me. And I think it's an interesting thing to acknowledge. You know, you're talking about that you, before you went to the emergency room, you had this discussion. And you come from a perspective of really knowing the systems, the surgeries, to be able to have these decisions, right? And some could argue that that could have been too late for you. I mean, I'm guessing you have some of that stuff totally figured out beforehand, but you were kind of going through, this is truly what I want. But it that's one of the things that I think of and that I feel like I am struggling with in trying to write things down and make decisions, is that I want to know in more real detail, what am I signing up for? And I don't feel, hearing not only my own experiences of hearing other people's stories when people are saying, well, this is what this medical procedure is. And somebody's like, no. You're not telling them what's going to actually happen afterwards. You know, right. One of the people I interviewed on the podcast a long time ago who had her DNR not respected, you know, and she's like, I am so lucky looking at the statistics. I am so lucky that I came back with everything. That is not norm, or that's not as common as we see it is on TV. And they don't tell you that. And you are the one living with those consequences. And I think those are such important conversations to have. So I appreciate your perspective on that, because I just think it's so valuable. If people really knew what they were signing up for, they would think differently. And that's fair. That is totally fine. You know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So again, more paradigm changes. And I think probably more conversations to be had around what patient autonomy looks like, what true informed consent, informed refusal looks like. And knowing that, I say this and it's tongue in cheek, but it's 100% true. Every single one of my patients die eventually. Not because of something I've done or haven't done, but we all die eventually. And so we have to get comfortable with that concept. So there's so many things and so many layers and textures to this. And I think in coming to grips with that concept actually will allow us to live differently and make different choices, hopefully while we're alive.
Yeah. Well, and like you say, everybody's going to have that experience eventually. And we say that about other things in life. And we say, well, you're going to have to do it. So why not make the best of it? But we don't say that often enough in a real way about our death.
Right.
Well, this has been I so appreciate you and your time. And I know we've talked about there are other conversations to have. And I think that I would love to have them in the future because you've got some wonderful perspectives. Is there any connection people can make with you about the work that you're doing that you would like to share?
Yeah, I'm just, coming out of my office, and so will not be seeing individual patients. And I'm developing an online education system and module for treating trauma, anxiety, and chronic illness. So you can check me out on Facebook looking for My Anxiety Code. And also you can Google my name my website is drmarylowder.com. And we're just putting the finishing touches on there. So those are ways you can get a hold of me. But Facebook, My Anxiety Code. And that's going to be a whole education about, a lot of the things we talked about, but looking at how anxiety, trauma, and chronic illness go hand in hand.
Mm-hmm.
Should be great.
Nice. That's exciting. I think that's very exciting.
Yes.
Well, wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing and being here. I think these are just such important conversations that I think we all need to be having or hearing and making, taking our own way and our own steps and our own, like you said, this is a paradigm shift. This isn't just an overnight thing. This is a process for all of us. What does it mean to us? What are these thoughts? How do I think about these things? And we need time and space in our life and our day to think about that, and let it process through us and figure out what does that mean for us?
Yes. Sounds great.
Great. Thank you so much.
Yes. Thank you. I love speaking about this and happy to be able to be a resource for you.
Wonderful. Yay. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mary, for sharing your thoughts and your time and your story with us. Really do appreciate your very unique perspective. One thing that I do want to say is if you have thoughts or questions, again, don't hesitate to leave your comments on the website notes page. Facebook, always a great way to interact as well. And while you're on Facebook, you can look up Mary's page at My Anxiety Code. You can also find Mary at drmarylowder.com. I hope you're doing well. Have a beautiful week. Hopefully there will be some more beautiful weather to enjoy wherever you are so that you can be outside and get some fresh air and some sun and some vitamin D. Yay, spring. Until next time, may you continue to find the pieces that fit beautifully into your health and wellness puzzle. Take good care. Till next time.